Refugees and border walls, woke celebs and socialist chic, social engineering and COVID lockdowns. It's easy to get wound up over what's happening in our country and in the world. That's why it's time for Act and Unwind, a weekly roundtable discussion tackling current events from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. Every Monday, join host Eric Cohen and Acton Institute experts, including Dr. Samuel Gregg, Reverend Robert Sirico, Dr. Stephen Barrows, and more in this weekly audio public square where news, politics, religion, and culture meet for an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. Act and Unwind will explain the news of the week through the Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics as it works to promote and to shape a society that is secure, free, and virtuous, one characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Act and Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or search Act and Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are available. That's acton.org/NR. To subscribe, please check it out. Inflation at 6.2, Rittenhouse on trial, and Christie versus Trump. We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Subtext and Masterworks. More about them in due course. If you listen to this podcast on nationalreview.com, we're delighted to have you, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed. Adding the streaming services out there from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Charlie, you completely blew the Virginia gubernatorial race with your bullheaded insistence that Terry McAuliffe was going to win despite all the evidence. But on the other side of the ledger, it looks like you have nailed the inflation story. Finally, the transitory people have been defeated in a complete rout with these latest inflation numbers. Big jump from September to October, when it seemed as though perhaps the numbers were elevated, but had been settling down in recent months. And then this eye-popping 6.2 annual increase, the biggest in more than 30 years. What do you make of it?
Well, the common denominator there is my propensity for pessimism.
You give MBD a hard time about that.
What I'm saying is that I didn't so much get the inflation story right as I adopted the same pose as in the McAuliffe case and just assumed we were in for a world of pain, which we are. So I think the most interesting part of this is the chasm that exists between the problems that Joe Biden as president is facing and the policies that Joe Biden as president is focused on. Joe Biden did not cause this. At least he did not cause it any more than did anyone else. Certainly, adding another $2 trillion in spending earlier in the year didn't help. Larry Summers said as much. But much of the coronavirus mitigation spending, or spending that was approved under those auspices, was signed by Donald Trump. And I think it would be churlish to say that the state of the economy at this exact moment is the sole fault of Joe Biden. But this is also the hand that Joe Biden has been dealt. This is the hand that House Democrats have been dealt. This is the hand that Senate Democrats have been dealt. And they may have small majorities, but they have majorities nevertheless. And I suspect that if we were looking at a Republican trifecta, the press would never tire of saying, given that people are suffering, and they are, why on earth are the Republicans with their slim majorities obsessed with passing an agenda that they had contrived years ago, sometimes decades ago. What is it that has led them to be so callous and obsessive, especially when to pass the Biden agenda would almost certainly, at least in the short term, be to make inflation worse? Joe Biden has started lying about this. He says that 17 Nobel Prize winning economists say that his plans, the so-called Build Back Better agenda, will limit inflation. But they don't say that. They say that it will limit inflation in the long term, and they point to certain industries and sectors. In the short term, it will make inflation worse. And yet that is what Joe Biden is obsessed with doing. And I think this is a political mistake, obviously, but I think it is a dereliction of duty. There are some things that President Biden could do. For a start, he could make it clear that he's aware of this, he's focused on this, and that it is going to form the majority of his policy attentions in the coming month. And then he could, for example, try to lower gas prices by not shutting down pipelines and expanding production. He could waive the Jones Act. He could change some union rules that are federally determined at ports and elsewhere. And of course, he could drop his gargantuan spending bill. It is amusing me, to put it mildly, that the defenses of the Build Back Better agenda now are tailored to what people are worried about without actually being related to what people are worried about. So we see Pete Buttigieg on television saying that the reason that we have supply chain issues and the reason we have labor shortages is because of a lack of childcare, as if that was true 2 or 3 years ago. And across the board, we have Democrats saying that we have to pass this massive bill because otherwise inflation will get worse. And that is nonsense. It's nonsense when Chuck Schumer says it. It's nonsense when Nancy Pelosi says it. It's nonsense when Joe Biden says it. And it's also being advanced in a really ham-fisted way. The Roosevelt Institute yesterday said that the Build Back Better agenda would help to defeat inflation because there's $10 billion in the package that will give the president powers that are directly related to the parts of the economy that are causing the inflation. To which the obvious answer is, well, then just pass that. Pass that $10 billion worth of spending. There's absolutely no reason that we have to wrap that $10 billion of spending up in a $1.5, $2, $3, $3.5 trillion package because we have inflation. So, you know, I'm baffled by the pigheadedness of the administration and the Democratic Party. And I'm baffled by the unwillingness of the press to shift away for a moment from its ESPN-style horse race coverage of the president's legislative agenda in favor of asking questions about why it is that this is what he is interested in, given that if you ask people and if you look at the economy, the contents of that agenda really don't intersect with what is happening on the ground.
So MBD, the rebranding of the infrastructure and the Build Back Better plans as anti-inflation measures is just hilarious. It reminds me when Biden gave his anti-crime speech, I think over the summer, they were suddenly seized with that issue and realized the political threat. So they said, oh yeah, this so-called COVID relief bill that we spent, it's also an anti-crime measure, you know, because community kids need some of the funds to hire cops, something that no one had ever thought of when they're putting that bill together or selling it up to that point. So I do think though, the biggest factor here driving the inflation is a mismatch globally between supply and demand. You see inflation going up in every other advanced country. We're going up more, to be sure, and the supply chain disruptions. So it's not directly Biden's fault. And I think that the transitory people that, you know, I was on board with during much of this were correct that that's essentially what's driving it. It's not like a monetary inflation that, you know, spun out of control in the 60s and the 70s and went on for years and years and years. But those factors have not proven transitory, and they're easily going to extend at least into next year. And then at the margins, I think, you know, the spending has been part of it, and not just, you know, the Biden spending, or maybe not even primarily, as Charlie was alluding to, the Biden spending, because a lot of this hasn't gone out the door yet. Now, the infrastructure spending obviously hasn't even been signed yet. A lot of the COVID relief bill has been sitting around. That's been a Republican criticism of it. But over the last 18 months, there was just a spigot of cash being spewed out of Washington, and that has stoked demand. And so the focus now should be on supply. How do you increase business in investment and manufacturing of goods and all the rest of it? So this is more kind of a deregulatory story and a labor union story, to the extent that all those kind of rules play into the supply chain difficulties, rather than just a pure spending story. But there's a fascinating New York Times piece today. You know, Charlie was pointing out how Biden's been misleading about what economists have been saying about the inflationary effects of Build Back Better. And this is a New York Times story saying, yeah, actually, most economists think in the short term, that program will, at the margins, add to inflation rather than diminish it.
Yeah, well, I mean, how could it not, right? I mean, you have, in other parts of the economy, you have labor shortages and raw material shortages and energy shortages. So the federal government going on a big spending spree and increasing overall demand for whatever they're building, even roads, they're going to have to compete in the market for labor, right? Which is already tight, and we're seeing the fastest rising of wages since the 1980s in the current market for labor. So yeah, it should be inflationary spending, and if in the infrastructure bill, at least at first, I agree with what you said that it's not a monetary driven inflation that we're seeing. You know, Bridgewater Capital, one of the big hedge funds in Connecticut, founded by Ray Dalio, put out a big note basically saying like, well, yeah, like it's kind of a transitory inflation. It's a demand shock. But the problem is, it's like they're basically saying it's transitory, but we can't see the end of it anytime soon, given the size of the mismatch between demand and supply. And they're basically saying supply is going up. There's even productive capacity is going up. That's why you're seeing, you know, China is sending a record number of container ships to the West Coast of the United States. Something they're well above their pre-pandemic level of trade with us, for good and ill, I'd add. But the houses that are going for sale are, on average, closing a week later, their sales. So there's tons of money out there chasing a limited number of goods, and that is necessarily going to be inflationary for a time. It's just a question of how quickly does the market adjust. I mean, we've seen like the price of lumber was sort of the you know, number one sign of horrible inflation, and then you saw it collapse as people brought it to market. So there's
one of my transitory friends I talked to this week was citing lumber.
Yeah,
the example of what should hopefully happen more broadly.
Well, and there, it could be, you know, some people have been talking about this concept of whackflation, where you get goods that go surge up, and then productive capacity expands very quickly to meet that demand. And then that productive capacity meets a slam in demand because people learn, oh, lumber's expensive. So, you know what, I'm not going to do the renovation project in my home. I'm going to buy a car, you know, instead. And then they shift their money. Then lumber gets cheap, and it takes a while for people to realize, oh, lumber's cheap again. So you kind of have people predicting you might see like real strange waviness in lines. And that wouldn't surprise me either, because no one in history has done what the major states in the world have done in the last year, which is try to shut off the economy and turn it on again. I mean, it's like, it's the most astonishing thing we've ever done. And it's actually amazing that it hasn't worked out worse than it has already, right? Like, I actually think the economy has shown an amazing resiliency in responding, even with this unpleasant side of effect of inflation. And I would be worried, if I'm a conservative right now, I'd be worried that the market is so dynamic and so fast at responding to these signals headed through the global price system, that this inflationary period where we're entering could just be the entree into a boom next spring and summer, and that we're getting out over our skis here.
That's right. We're back onto your theme about how much you fear an economic boom.
I fear, well, no, I want the roaring 20s for sure. Although that comes with its own giddiness and insanity. I believe we deserve it after the last 20 years, especially after the last two. But I'm just saying, as a political matter, saying like, we know the economy is going to go bad for Democrats next year, I'm not sure of that. Not when, if goods come to the market, what people are going to feel is, hey, wages are up. There's tons of opportunity for jobs. There's tons of job opportunities out there. Work, labor has the labor market by the short ones, and people's lifestyles are getting better.
But the other side of the coin on the labor market, yeah, it's a tight labor market, which is great, and wages have been up, which is great. But inflation has eroded all that away. I mean, the real value of wages has actually declined over the last year. So, you know, you have these stories of people scratching their heads. Well, why, when all these other economic indicators are so great, why do people not feel
right
good about the economy? And that's why. I mean, wages are actually going down. And I think one of these polls the other day had Biden's 57%, I think, disapprove on Biden's handling of the economy. I mean, that's extraordinary. And it must be a huge amount of that must be people actually feeling this in their pocketbook. And Charlie, that's where another aspect of all this kind of COVID relief that came out of Washington, another inflationary effect was diminishing the supply of labor. So, you know, you don't have the truckers you need, et cetera. And then overall, the progressive program is almost just baked in the cake to be at the margins inflationary, because what they do is they put all sorts of strictures on supply of goods with new regulations and licensing requirements and all the rest of it. And then they subsidize demand and say, oh, look, we've made it cheaper, when actually they've made it more expensive, and they're just spending more on government on the other side of the ledger. So you see this in the housing market, obviously, you see it in healthcare, you see it in higher education. And it's what they also want to do with childcare and the Build Back Better program.
I find the fingers in the ears, la la la, no it won't approach of progressives toward basic economics baffling. But that's where they are. I mean, Biden's first approach was inflation isn't happening. Now it is happening. And flooding the economy with federal money will help. We're apparently going to fix things being too expensive by subsidizing them. What happens when you subsidize something? People pocket the difference. Now, there are some exceptions if you're willing to tightly regulate the market. But as we've seen with healthcare, and as we've seen with higher education, if you throw money at people, they say thank you very much, and they build it into the baseline. It's not just conservatives, oddly enough, who can see this. There are some on the left. I think Matt Brunig, who is certainly not a conservative, hates conservatives, has pointed this out as regards childcare. But the soft center and progressive left They just can't see it. And I think what depresses me the most about it is that government programs do not get judged in the way that private sector businesses are. They can't go out of business. And I suspect that if they do get their childcare provisions through, we will go at National Review from saying this won't work, this is what will happen, to this doesn't work, and this is what is happening. But it will still be extremely hard to repeal, because ultimately the political question that those who are trying to pass it want to answer is this fair? And they will pass it on the grounds that it's not fair, and they will hold on to it on the grounds that it would be unfair not to do it. And all we will do is increase our debt, increase our tax burden, increase prices, bring more people into dependence on the government. I'm not just talking about the end user. I'm talking about the people who provide services that are subsidized by the government, who then become clients, and on and on and on we roll. And that's one reason why it's so important to stop this. It's not just a short-term question of inflation and the economy in general. It's the long-term risks here. And the cynic would say that the Democratic Party really has no compunction whatsoever about making people clients. And look at the relationship it has with the teachers' unions. So I'm somewhat fatalistic on this, because I don't know how to argue with people who just say, la, 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 no, it won't.
So I think really the biggest vulnerability they have in terms of their responsibility for stoking inflation is oil and gas, right? Now, the oil and gas market is weird. You know, the prices are way, way up. Apparently, people think, in my loose reading on this, that there's going to be a glut of supply by next year, and you know, maybe the prices will crash back down. But explicitly, the Democratic program is to make oil and gas more expensive. It's to make it harder for people to fill their tank at the gas stations, harder for them to heat their homes in the winter. And that's just an enormous vulnerability to them.
But they don't have the courage of their convictions. And thus you see the absurd spectacle of the president of the United States, who presides over a country that is more or less energy independent and has got there despite the predictions in the space of 15 years, saying, I don't want more of this horrible climate change inducing dirty fossil fuel production on our land. I will stop it where I can. I will shut down pipelines where I can. Also, OPEC, please, please increase your production so that Americans don't hate me when they go to fill up their cars.
Yeah, it's pathetic and galling. And even some OPEC officials are like, what are you talking about? Aren't you the anti-oil guy? Why are you coming begging to us? So MBD, exit question to you. Inflation will be higher or lower next year this time? Higher or lower?
I believe it'll be low.
Is another option.
I believe it'll be lower, but unfortunately, Joe Biden won't take my advice, which is, you know, we need the semiconductors, we need everything that is the product of East Asian industrial policy, so we should meet it by soaking up Western industrial policy. We need shipping containers to go back across the Pacific Ocean. I say we fill them up with our diversity, equity, and inclusion consultants that we're producing with our industrial policy, ship them to East Asia where they're so desperately needed in those undiverse countries, and we reverse the political influence of China on the United States by influencing them. They send us cars, we send them post-grads.
You know, you're right. We do have an industrial policy that's supporting the diversity.
I'm dead serious.
Charlie, higher, lower, or the same?
It's going to be higher.
Why?
Because we have a monomaniacal political class that isn't particularly affected by it, and that wants what it wants and doesn't care about the consequences.
So I'm going to say lower. I've been wrong before, but I think the supply chain problems will be alleviated. You know, maybe Biden and I forget whether it's you, MBD, who is saying this, or Jim, that he's just focused on the supply chain monomaniacally, to use Charlie's term, And they seem to be sort of going there, and maybe they can make a difference at the margins. But ultimately, the private sector and companies are going to figure this out, figure out how to at least make it better. And then I think, you know, globally, supply should catch up to demand or get closer. But I don't think we're going to be anywhere near what the Fed is saying. You know, the Fed, I guess the forecast is below 2% next year, and that's not going to happen. Just housing alone should ensure that doesn't happen. So certainly higher than 2, but I'm going to say lower than where we are now on an annual basis, 6.2. So with that, let's pause and hear from our first sponsor this episode. Love the humanities, but not so much a fan of listening to lectures? Then try the Subtext Literature and Film Podcast at subtextpodcast.com. In each episode, philosopher Wes Allwun and poet Aaron Olonik explore life's big questions by way of an in-depth discussion of a great work of fiction, film, drama, or poetry. In the tradition of a liberal arts seminar, Subtext focuses on the insights into the human condition that make these texts timeless, insights that can change the way we view ourselves and live our lives. Recent episodes include conversations about the relationship between imagination and ambition in Shakespeare's Macbeth, how to square honor and justice in the film The Godfather, the connection between the political and the spiritual in the short stories of Anton Chekhov, the power of art to preserve in Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias, and the developmental psychology of magic in The Wizard of Oz. So if you love close readings of great books and film, go to subtextpodcast.com or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. That's Subtext Podcast, Subtext Podcast.com, or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. Please check it out. So MBD, we have the ongoing Kyle Rittenhouse trial. I guess it began last week, but really reached a new level of interest with the cable stations taking it gavel to gavel every day this week. And because our political culture is completely insane, just no one's being rational about this. First of all, he never should have been charged. I mean, this is a clear case of self-defense, which has been made completely evident in this trial. But you have folks on the left just basically saying, hang him, just hang the guy. I guess because he's perceived as being on the wrong side because he was anti-rioter. Hakeem Jeffries, who I'm sure has inveighed continually over the years about mass incarceration, just says he should be jailed and the key should be thrown away, even after the evidence that we've seen over the last week. And then you have some people on the right who, you know, I think the reasonable take on Rittenhouse is he shouldn't have been there. He didn't know how to handle a gun, shouldn't have been running around this chaotic situation, even if his intentions were good. But he's not a murderer. But you have some people on the right wanting to puff him up into some hero and saying that this is the kind of young person we need if the country is going to be saved. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't want to necessarily puff him up as a hero, but I actually do think he had pretty good trigger discipline. And I think he did know how to handle that gun. He was clearly overcharged, but the left is committed to a mythology of the right as full of, and basically maybe a mythology of the country, that the right and the red America are full of slack-jawed, sling blade style morons who will be activated into terroristic violence if they hear the wrong message. And so if they hear the wrong message from Trump, there must be some kind of horrific violent act in response because of it. And so here in the Rittenhouse case, they kind of have the, the sacramental instantiation of it. Like, here he is. So it's, a lot of the left's response to this will be totally impervious to evidence, right? Because they believe it on a mythic level, not on a factual level. And that's why the court, now the court is coming under attack from the left, where you're seeing people say, oh, this judge, let him put on his Klan hood because he's giving the local prosecutor a tough time because the local prosecutor is trying to introduce evidence that was ruled inadmissible and doing all sorts of things because the case is weak. And we see it over and over again that people are overcharged when there's this political meaning to the crimes, and that evidence goes out the wayside. And we see, I mean, it's like, how many years have we been since like the Duke LaCrosse case? Like, we see this all the time. I don't know, we shouldn't be surprised by it. I was surprised that Rittenhouse was put on the stand. I thought he did himself well overall.
Do you have any doubt, MBD, because this is another thing that was prevalent on the left, LeBron James, you know, that great heroic and courageous social commentator, said, on Twitter, when he was breaking down Rittenhouse and the trial had to be interrupted, he's like, I didn't see any tears. I don't believe it. You know, I'm Morning Joe, they were talking loosely about this as well. Did you think that was sincere, that emotional display?
I think he's on that stand and his life is on the line. And not only his life, but of course he's talking about what any normal person would experience as the most traumatic moments of their life when they took the life of another human being. Unfortunately, we have a culture of people who basically are raised on comic book stories, and they think that anyone who does something bad, even by their own lights, is like bottomlessly malevolent and enjoys the bad thing they did. Like, you could even imagine a case. I believe apply to Kyle Rittenhouse, but you can imagine a case where a Kyle Rittenhouse type goes to one of these things. He is carried by his passions into the attempt to stamp out a riot, and it is guilty of felony murder of two people. And yet he might still cry on the stand because he's a human being and he's talking about the most grave matters of life and justice and who he is. So I don't understand, you know, I just don't understand the incomprehension even from the liberal view. I think it's utterly childish. And of course he should be emotional. Of course his nerves should be fired up to the absolute maximum. I mean, it looked like he was having a panic attack on the stand. That's totally human in my book.
I had the same reaction. I think they his lawyers probably knew he was going to do that because there are certain things that even those of us, thank God, have never experienced anything nearly as traumatic as that. And pray God never will. There's just certain things like John Boehner, you know, whenever he was talking about his father's bar, he'd start to cry. And like people, you know, it was kind of funny and people mocked him for it. But there's something that was just deeply touching to Boehner about that. And it was sincere. And God, you know, you go through what Rittenhouse did. Every time you talk about it, that's probably what happens. And his lawyers probably knew it. So I have no doubt it was sincere. So Charlie, what would you make of the argument that some people might make? Okay, you know, this is an attenuated case, but something really bad happened here. So let's just charge him up and throw it to a jury.
What would I make of that? I think you know what I would make of that. It's the resident
rhetorical question.
Criminal justice squish. I don't think he's guilty of anything he's been charged with, except potentially the weapons charges, which are a misdemeanor, which are usually dispensed with in Wisconsin with probation, and which are extremely... what's the word? Loosely... badly, illegibly written. The rest of it is absurd. And I don't think one needs to care whether he's a good or a bad person, whether he should or shouldn't have been there, whether the events were nice or ugly. The evidence isn't there. And so those who want to, as Hakeem Jeffries put it, lock him up and throw away the key in the prisons that Hakeem Jeffrey wants to abolish, are going after the judge. It's not the judge's fault. In fact, I think the judge has been rather good. And I think that the attacks on the judge show two things. One, that the left has become extremely illiberal, including on matters of criminal justice. And two, that our politics have changed over the last 40 years in ways we haven't quite caught up with yet. That judge is routinely described in the left-leaning press, on Twitter, and by members of Congress who should know better, as some sort of Trump fan, some sort of right-winger. Well, I don't know his personal politics, but I do know when he was appointed and why. That judge was appointed in 1983 by a progressive Democrat. And in 1983, progressive Democrats believed in things like presumption of innocence, putting the thumb on the scales, which our Constitution does for the defense, and the Fifth Amendment. And from what I can see, that judge still believes in those things. That judge would have been in the good graces of the ACLU in 1983 and in the bad graces of the Archie Bunker types. But because far too many people in the press want this suspect to be locked up, they've suddenly abandoned all of those principles, if they ever held them. And they're latching on stupidly to what are either norms within our criminal justice system, or are norms at least for that judge. One of which, for example, was that the judge said at the outset that the two people who were killed and the one person who was shot but survived by Kyle Rittenhouse could not be referred to as victims. That makes sense. It's also standard practice for that judge. There's a good piece on Slate about this, of all places. That judge, given that the question here is whether or not they were victims, whether or not this was homicide, whether or not this was self-defense, that judge decided that it would be prejudicial to decide them from the get-go, to describe them from the get-go as victims, much in the same way as it would be prejudicial to describe somebody who had accused of sexual assault as a survivor if it was not clear whether or not it had happened. In concert with that decision, this judge prevented the defense from bringing up extraneous information about one of the men that Rittenhouse killed, that he had just come out of a mental institution. Now, it really doesn't take too much research to get a good impression of who the judge is. Of course, he's the kind of guy who will lecture a prosecutor for deliberately and willfully violating the decisions that he has already made, for deliberately and willfully violating the Fifth Amendment by implying twice that there was something suspicious about Rittenhouse's having exercised his Fifth Amendment rights. But it doesn't have to. And I am much more worried here about the reflexive behavior of many people who have power and influence than I am about this trial. I'm usually somewhat reticent when it comes to criminal trials. I think it is broadly inappropriate for public figures to comment on ongoing trials, not least because if there's a mistrial, the next jury may have been exposed to the comments and the atmosphere. So at the very least, I would like to see some sort of respect for the system, and I'm not. If you look at the coverage, it's essentially beginning from the premise that he's obviously guilty and there's no need to have a trial. And then it's coupled with this question begging that he is going to get off only because America is a white supremacist nation. America loves the Second Amendment. America hates Black Lives Matter. The judge is corrupt, etc., etc., etc. Well, you know, the much simpler explanation here is that the state of Wisconsin charged him with crimes that he didn't commit and then appointed an incompetent prosecutor to push them forward. And, you know, at one point in our history, the Democratic Party and the press would have been appalled by that. But something has happened in the last decade. Something has happened so that if the defendant or the accused is disliked or is seen to be an avatar of something that is disliked, it all goes out of the window. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get from figures such as Hakeem Jeffries saying that we should defund the police, that we should abolish prisons, to saying lock him up and throw away the key mid-trial as a member of the federal legislature.
Yeah.
And I find this deeply, deeply distressing, not least because suppose that the Hakeem Jeffries of the world are sincere, which I don't think they are, but there are some really sincere people out there who care about criminal justice. How do they think the people that they want to be treated well are going to fare if the people they don't like are railroaded? You cannot have a system like that. So that's been my takeaway. I don't think that the charges are sustainable. I don't know how the case will come out. Well, but my goodness me, what a horrible setup.
That's a segue to the exit question. MBD, will he, Rittenhouse, be convicted of murder, yes or no?
No.
Charlie, you want to venture an answer?
I don't know. I don't think that all of the charges other than the firearms charge, which is a misdemeanor, are first degree homicide. That's how they describe it in Wisconsin. The language of the law doesn't say murder. I don't think you could tally what we've heard in the court with the idea that this was premeditated.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost like the prosecution is trying to go for, it's almost like a constructed felony murder case, right? Like it reflects the lefty rhetoric on Twitter of, well, he took a gun across state lines, which he didn't do, but oh, he did this, he was in the middle of doing something wrong. So everything that follows after that becomes his criminal fault, including the death of others. And I just don't think it's going to work.
Yeah, it'll just be shocking. I mean, a shocking miscarriage of justice if he is convicted of murder, and I don't think he will be. With that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor, Masterworks. March 2020 was a nightmare. With COVID spreading like wildfire, the market was plummeting, down 16% on a single day, with reports of the economy getting worse by the day. In the months that followed, JCPenney went under, Hertz filed Chapter 11, and Virgin Atlantic went bankrupt. Many people lost their jobs, and over the year that followed, their homes. But there was an asset that held its value. In fact, during the same crash, it actually returned an average of 16% gains. What if I told you this asset is contemporary art? Would you believe me if I told you contemporary art outperformed the S&P 500 between 1995 and 2020 and has been so hot that the Wall Street Journal recently said art is among the hottest markets on earth? Previously, this lucrative market was off limits to everyday investors. But what most people don't know is everyday investors can now buy shares of million-dollar paintings from artists like Picasso, Banksy, and Monet. There's only one platform that lets you invest in this asset class. It's called Masterworks. They're already worth more than $1 billion, and more than 250,000 investors have signed up. Many of them are listeners of this very podcast. You can skip the wait list by going to masterworks.io/editors. Just keep in mind, this is a limited asset, so these incredible offerings have previously sold out in hours. Once again, that's masterworks.io/editors. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer. Please check it out. So MBD, we got to get the incomparable Sarah Schutte out of here in a little bit. She has a hard out. So we're going to do this final topic, exit question style. Will Chris Christie's attacks on Donald Trump notably launched over the last week or so, although he also swiped at him at a speech out at the Reagan Foundation. Will these attacks work? Yes or no?
Yes. I think Christie is timing this just about right. I think Donald Trump is slowly, the air has been coming out of his political bubble since January 6th. And since Joe Biden took office, he's less and less the subject of our politics. And Christie is good at blowing people up, whether it's, you know, New Jersey teachers unions or Marco Rubio.
Or himself.
Or himself, too. No, it's true. But he, you know, he can do damage.
Charlie Cook, will it work, yes or no?
I think it might help to damage Trump. I'm not sure it will work out for Chris Christie, whose ultimate aim seems to be president himself. But this is an important signpost in the road as to where things are headed. Chris Christie's not some rando. I mean, he endorsed Trump and was somewhat seminal in turning the tide in his favor. At least it felt like that at the time, back in 2015, 2016. And he's been fairly defensive of Trump. So for him to say, okay, enough, shows you where the wind is headed.
Yeah, so the key ambiguity and the question I asked is what does the word work in that context mean? So I welcome this line of attack from Chris Christie. I think he's sincere in lodging it. It's not often I disagree with all upon it over at Hot Air, who just we all admire his work. He's so prolific and his judgment is so sound on such a wide range of things. But he's up with a post saying, "Oh, this is Christie angling to get a cabinet position in the second Trump administration because Trump will have to somehow buy him off and get him back in the tent, or maybe this is Christie angling to be Trump's Veep nominee because the establishment will say, you know, after Trump inevitably sweeps the nomination in 2024, you need to heal the party. You need to get Christie on board." I don't think any of that is right. I think Christie, you know, he like politicians do, he saw the main chance in 2016. He told himself that, you know, Trump was going to win and that the best way to influence and try to make him better was to get on board early. That didn't work out very well for Christie in terms of, you know, he had control of the transition, but that didn't last. But he was advising Trump to the very end of his presidency, and I think was genuinely and sincerely shocked by January 6th, and now has made a break and is passionately anti-Trump. And someone had to say this eventually. I don't know whether it's going to get any traction now at the moment, but it is a key juncture. And it's just a huge vulnerability of Trump's, because this is a huge element of Stop the Steal, is just not admitting that he lost and lost to an enfeebled mediocrity, Joe Biden. And it wasn't anyone else's fault. It was a winnable race and Donald Trump lost it. So I'm both a Youngkinite and a Christieite, and that I think the main line of effort here should be what Youngkin did, basically, you know, tiptoeing around Trump a little bit, winning Trump voters over, convincing them to support, you know, a better candidate and a better program, which is what Youngkin has. But someone has to go directly, and more people have to do this, has to go directly at Trump. So whether it'll work, maybe I'll say no, it's not going to work, but it's an important and welcome development. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, what have you been up to?
I watched the new Bond film, finally, which is available on rental through Apple. And I liked it. It was very good. It was a little somber and emotional, but, you know, oddly, what I liked most about it was it returned a little bit of the silliness and campiness to Bond and Bond villains. There was a kind of ongoing bit about an eyeball that felt like very classic Bond, with a physically malformed villain in the mix. And I enjoyed it.
Charlie.
My wife brought home a new board game yesterday.
Oh, Zan would be so delighted. Zan will be jealous, in fact, probably.
Well, it's not actually a board game, I suppose. It's Tetris. You ever play Tetris on the Game Boy or any other computer?
I was never a Tetris guy, but I know a lot of people were.
But this is Tetris in real life. This is the opposite of what Mark Zuckerberg is trying to do, which is to put everything in the real world into the virtual world. This is taking the virtual world and putting it in the real world. You have these transparent, rectangular-shaped stands, and then you have cards, and each card shows which piece you have and which piece is coming next. And then you have to actually put them in and watch everyone else's to see who's doing well. And then whoever gets the most rows completed within a certain time. And it sounds silly, but it's actually enormously fun. At least it's enormously fun to your three-year-old start shoving in the pieces at the wrong angle, and then you have to go get a knife for the seventh time and pull them out. But Tetris the board game is a big hit in the Cook household.
So I hate hard pastries or hard cookies. I think soft chocolate chip cookies are so much better than crisp chocolate chip cookies. So I hate scones, for instance. I don't know why anyone eats a scone. I don't know why scones exist, except for maybe they're a medieval holdover before we had the the means to make actually soft pastries. But the one exception I make is biscotti, because you can dip it. So it's okay that it's hard, because you know you're gonna dip it in coffee. And my wife just got this. If you're interested in the brand, you know, at me or email me. I don't have it right in front of me, but this incredible like chocolate chunk biscotti. That's basically like a long, narrow chocolate chip cookie, basically. And it is so good. You know, I find myself in the afternoon, I'll have two of them, and it's like, you know, there's only one left. And I should I go and have the third, because I'm not gonna have one tomorrow, or do I really need it now? And it's just so, so good. But with that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is from the end row issue of the magazine that just came out. There's a piece by Hadley Arkus, Roe as Anti-Law, that's very good and deep and true. And the whole issue is great, but that one really kicks it off at a very high level.
Charlie Cook, what's your pick? Do you have one this time?
I do have one this time. I may have had one last time if you hadn't rushed on after my flub. Mine is Carl Smith, the year's best film to date. As I've probably said 100 times, I am not especially good at movies. And so often when I read movie reviews, I think, yeah, whatever, I don't want to. But this one, about a movie made by Kenneth Branagh called Belfast, really did make me want to see it. And I suppose I admire Carl for being able to do what I can't, which is watch a movie and then have interesting things to say about it.
MBD, did you tweet about this movie or write about it, or am I making that up?
I didn't. I might have tweeted about it, but I didn't write about it.
So my pick is Rittenhouse Prosecutors Seek to Criminalize Constitutional Self-Defense by Andy McCarthy. Little backstory here. Andy wasn't really following this trial. I texted him, sent him this tweet when one of these assailants of Rittenhouse admitted that Rittenhouse didn't shoot at him until he had assailed Rittenhouse and pointed a gun at him. And Andy's like, I haven't been really following this trial, but let me get up on it. And then just instantly is totally up on it and writes what might be the best piece anyone's written about the Rittenhouse trial so far. And it's just another reminder, if you needed one, that on these sort of questions, you can just take anything that Andy writes to the bank. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the aforementioned incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Subtext and Masterworks. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.